Support for This Day in Esoteric Political History comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between. And they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, October 5th, 1987, the Senate Judiciary Committee sent Robert H. Bork's Supreme Court nomination to the Senate floor with a recommendation that he be rejected. Earlier that summer, President Reagan had nominated Bork for Associate Justice of the Supreme Court to replace retiring Associate Justice Lewis Powell. Throughout the summer, there was mounting opposition to Bork's nomination from moderates and liberals, mostly concerned about his civil rights opinions. We will get into all this stuff. But the nomination proceeded, even though it seemed in many ways doomed from the start. Eventually, Bork's nomination hearings would become a major political and media event, tons of advertising and lobbying and nastiness and swirling stories. He would be voted down. Republicans would cry foul. And if anyone kind of knows his name now, it's because he has become a verb, borking, which is basically mounting a major opposition to a judicial candidate. That seems par for the course right now, but it is important to remember a moment at which that felt like new and interesting and changed the game a little bit. And so that is really, in many ways, what we're here to discuss, the nomination of Bork, but also the legacy of how that played out. Here to do that, as always, are Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
And our special guest for this episode is Jay Willis, legal journalist, editor-in-chief of the new legal website Balls and Strikes, which is sort of offers a critical progressive perspective and analysis on the courts. So, Jay, thank you for doing this, and congratulations on your new site, Balls and Strikes.
Thank you on all counts. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I will also say one of my favorite pieces you've written is about sort of media coverage of the courts, which I think has such a big part here in how, you know, this is in many ways, Kelly and Nikki know this, I think every story is a media story, but this is in many ways a media story. But let's start on the Bork nomination. You can tell us a little bit about who he was and what the concerns were, but this particular moment that we're marking here, October 5th, right? It's at the end of October that he gets voted down. But this moment, October 5th, he comes out of committee, but with a recommendation that he not be approved. I mean, that strikes me as like a poison pill of sorts or an interesting wrinkle. I mean, how, you know, what do we make that initial recommendation? Don't approve this guy, but, you know, have at it.
Well, like Brett Kavanaugh, three decades later, Bork was a no doubt about it conservative who was nominated to replace a moderate conservative on the court, Lewis Powell. So his confirmation to the court would have been a huge shift in its trajectory going forward. And Democrats, politically, to their credit, really seized on that. There were a lot of reasons, as I know we'll get into, a lot of red flags to raise, let's say. And they mounted a strong public opposition campaign from the beginning. And by the time it got to this point that we're talking about, public opinion was really against him. A majority of Americans opposed Bork's confirmation. And I think you can really contrast that, for example, with President Reagan's other nominees to the court. So Sandra Day O'Connor confirmed unanimously. Antonin Scalia, I believe, confirmed the year before, also unanimously. Anthony Kennedy, who would eventually take the seat that Robert Bork was denied, confirmed unanimously. William Rehnquist, whose nomination during the Nixon administration to be an associate justice under President Reagan was nominated to be Chief Justice. Very controversial both times, but still he got the support of about a third of Senate Democrats. Mm-hmm. And then a couple years later, David Souter under Bush confirmed 90-9. By contrast, Bork was rejected eventually on a bipartisan basis, 58-42. So there was strong opposition to his far-right extremist agenda, frankly, and as again, I know we're going to get into, conservatives sort of to this day decry this as a smear, but really it's better described as as an L. Like, you put the wrong guy forward. People didn't like him, yeah. And both the public and the Senate rejected him. But they've been real big mad about it ever since.
Big mad is a pretty good way to describe it. I think it comes up anytime the Supreme Court is mentioned on the right. And I think it's really important that you have that precedent of Antonin Scalia just a year earlier getting a unanimous vote, because it shows you that there was something different about Bork. Because Scalia was pretty conservative, and so was Bork, but he had a couple of different kinds of baggage, right? He has the baggage of being the person during Watergate who allows Nixon to fire the special prosecutor in the midst of the Saturday Night Massacre. So he has this role that he played in this major presidential scandal. But he also had made so many statements about what Democrats saw as their major achievements of the 1960s and 1970s when it came to Black civil rights, when it came to civil rights for women. He opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Yeah. He, I think, made clear that he was not a big fan of Roe v. Wade as a ruling. And so at a moment when Democrats really understood that the courts had played an important role in advancing civil rights, they didn't want someone who opposed that on the court.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think there are a lot of things. If there were one thing that he was like maybe opposed to, if it was abortion or if it was, you know, like the teaching of evolution or something like that. But he's opposed to so many hallmark things that you mentioned, Nikki. I think most prominent of all is the opposition to the Civil Rights Act. You know, that's something that across the board, most people could see that as positive legislation. But also the way that Ted Kennedy gives this scathing, like, if you let him on this court, this is what he will do. He will, like, roll back time on us. And that's a kind way of sort of saying what he says. But that really sets up sort of the framework of how people started to think about the ways they were going to vote for him or not.
Jay, to that point, I mean, is your sense that the Bork opposition was something that sort of mounted and coalesced and was pushed on by media narratives and sort of this hint of, I don't know, swirling stories and scandal and so forth? Or was it just like, we're going to look at this guy and he's, you know, diametrically different from where we, you know, where we stand, and we're going to oppose him from the jump? Because I think that that starts to really get at some of the sort of fundamental questions of how this is remembered, you know, as a story that is about spin and narrative and scandal, or is it a story just about difference of fundamental, you know, judicial stance?
Yeah, for Senate Democrats, it's just hard for me to imagine that opposing Robert Bork was that hard. I mean, he'd been an outspoken academic. He'd been a judge for a while. He had a long paper trail. And again, to give you the sense of where this guy fell on the ideological spectrum, he was neck and neck within the Reagan administration for the seat that went to Scalia, and that seat went to Scalia largely, that first seat, largely went to him because he was younger and healthier than Bork at the time, and they thought Scalia would be on longer. So when another seat came up, they just went right back to their guy. But they had no doubt that he would vote to overturn Roe. And, like, good conservatives, smart conservatives, they don't oppose civil rights legislation. They pay lip service to the idea of civil rights and then systematically hollow out the mechanisms for enforcing them. Mm-hmm. Shout out John Roberts. Like, Bork's problem is that he said the quiet part out loud. It wasn't unfair for senators to reject his nomination based on literally the things that he said. All Democrats had to do was, right, like the functional equivalent of holding up the whiteboard in the confirmation hearings and be like, here's some things this guy said. Are we cool with this or no? And as it turned out, the answer is mostly no.
And I think as one data point, Bork was someone who said that he thought that the courts had ruled wrongly on poll taxes, that they actually weren't something that restricted people's constitutional rights. And, you know, Americans, I think, broadly disagree with that. And certainly Senate Democrats disagreed with that. So these aren't just, you know, we feel like he's squishy on civil rights. He had been pretty clear on where he stood on federal intervention on behalf of civil rights.
It's a great quote too, right? He said that the poll tax was like a very small poll tax, just like a little incursion on your right to vote. Just a little
tiny, baby tiny incursion.
It's, okay.
The police are just peeking in your house.
No, I know.
gosh. You know, if we're sort of starting to make a little list of ways in which this is misremembered, because I think ultimately we want to kind of have a sense of how this is remembered and misremembered and so forth, I think one of the really telling detail here is Joe Biden plays a role here, right? He's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. As we're marking, you know, there's a recommendation that they not confirm him. He is very clear in saying, look, we don't think Bork is going to get confirmed. And he kind of offers Reagan a chance to pull the nomination, which does happen from time to time and is a political loss, but I would argue maybe less of a political loss than, you know, running headfirst into a buzzsaw. And so I'm curious how that complicates the story here, that Reagan, you know, didn't take an opportunity to maybe save a little face here, knowing what was likely coming.
I mean, I think he does it in part because there's so much conservative support for Bork, and he wants to show that he is standing by his guy. I mean, this is part of Reagan's approach. Now, often he backs off when things look unpopular, but this was pretty important to conservatives, and I think it was pretty important to Bork. It wasn't entirely clear that Bork himself was going to willingly step aside. Yeah. He's a pretty outspoken guy, and not someone, as we know from what happens next, that would go quietly into that good night.
And he basically says Reagan's going to have to do this. Like, he's going to have to pull his nomination. He's not going to walk away from it.
Yeah, there was sort of behind the scenes chatter that White House officials wanted Bork to withdraw, and Bork wouldn't do it. And if I remember correctly, he went to the White House at one point and asked Reagan to give like a primetime speech, a primetime address, like defending him, and which Reagan did not do. So Bork just kind of went on his own PR campaign, and he really sort of leaned into this impending martyrdom. He said, I want the vote. I want the up or down vote, which, you know, it comes across as this high profile loss for the administration. But as I think we'll see in the long term, it's really paid dividends in terms of galvanizing the conservative legal movement to unite behind their nominees, especially their nominees who come under criticism, to make sure that what happened to Bork, this like early leader in the conservative legal movement, an early faculty advisor to the Federalist Society, to make sure that that didn't happen to anyone else.
So the phrase Borking appears pretty soon after this vote. So Jay, you know, maybe characterized, as you were just getting at, characterize for us how the word Borking has lived on and how in conservative legal circles, the story of what happened to Robert Bork has solidified into a sort of conventional wisdom.
Yeah, there's, in most usages of Borking these days, there's a critical element is that it involves an attack, a vilification that's unfair. The sense that what happened to the person has to be fundamentally wrong in some way. And again, based on his record, based on his performance in these committee hearings, you can watch him, they're on YouTube. He comes across as real academic, real pretentious, really out of touch with what his confirmation represented to real people who weren't law professors. My favorite is when he talked about how he wanted to be on the Supreme Court because it would be a, quote, intellectual feast. And it's like, who talks like that, man? but it's hard for me to see how Bork's defeat there is unfair unless you're a Republican who defines that word very, very narrowly to mean a result that I personally do not like. But it's taken on this outsized importance in conservative legal circles. As I mentioned, he was sort of an early hero of the movement, and his presumed confirmation, along with that of Scalia, was supposed to be like the real ascendance of originalism and a triumph of this movement. There's an interview with Stephen Calabresi, one of the co-founders of the Federalist Society, who talks about sort of the fallout. He says, I'm quoting here, "People felt genuinely outraged. They felt the way if their father or mother had not been confirmed to the Supreme Court, or some close personal friend." He also says he named his son Robert, quote, "I'm sure because of my admiration for him." Mm-hmm. Now, personally, I've never had my mom or dad or friends be nominated to the court. Like, that's not that's not an emotion with which I can personally empathize, but like just to give you a sense of where this guy is in within that movement. Mm. And if you ask a conservative law student or a young lawyer today, they will absolutely go to the mattresses for Robert Bork. Mm. And it's like, dude, weren't you born in like 1996? Like, how do you, what's going on with that? But they see this as the original sin of the judicial confirmation wars that excuses, justifies everything else that's come since then. Mm.
But there was a media circus around this, right? There was immense amounts of lobbying. There was tons of money being spent on advertising. There were special interest groups gearing up. I think this was an interesting media moment. But, you know, I'm curious just what you make of the fact that all of the stuff that we've been saying may be true, but it is also true that I think for a lot of people, these hearings felt different and heated and public and a little bit like dragging through the mud in a way that maybe stuff hadn't felt before.
I mean, I think that's right, but I think it's also important to remember that televised, lengthy judicial confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court were a relatively new thing.
Yeah.
That judicial confirmation hearings, to the extent they even happened, tended to be brief affairs until just a decade or two earlier. And this was contentious, and so lots of people watched and kept an eye on it. You know, Bork was a pretty polarizing figure. And then you couple this, you know, a few years later with the hearings for Clarence Thomas, which were also very much watched on television and
must-see TV.
Yeah. And contentious, right? I think it is the start of a new era of how Americans consumed judicial nomination hearings.
Yeah. And I mean, there's little details in here that I think are mostly the fault of, like, you know, the rise of cable news and so forth. But, you know, they pulled Robert Bork's video rental history and poured through all the videos that he had rented. Like, I don't think that's the reason that Democrats voted against him. But nevertheless,
There's a Blockbuster file.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it paid off during the Clarence Thomas trial.
Sorry. None of our listeners know what Blockbuster is.
we haven't done an episode explaining what Blockbuster is, so we have to. But you know, I just do think, and again, maybe this, as I said, mostly lies at the feet of the media, not at the feet of Democrats. But there was definitely a kind of new era of swirl going on here.
Yeah, to the extent that, I mean, obviously Robert Bork's video rental history could not care less about that. But to the extent that this was a media circus, that to the extent that there was more coverage, more public discussion of this than confirmation hearings had previously been subject to, I think that's just the politicization of this event is just a reflection of the political nature of the Supreme Court. People understood how much was at stake with this. There are a lot of cases that people knew would come down the other way if Robert Bork, instead of Lewis Powell or you know, a different, less extremist conservative nominee, were in that seat. I think that the public attention on this was a completely reasonable, rational reaction to the stakes here.
That's actually a really fascinating way to maybe recalibrate what we understand as the Bork story, which is, you know, the first time that everyone understood the political stakes. You know, it used to be maybe something that was like more of a secret or a sort of, you know, but now the public just understood what the game that had been played all along, what the game really was. But as we wrap up to that point, you know, about what would have happened with Bork on the court, I'm curious if you can do a little sliding doors of what the court would have looked like over the next 10, 15, 20 years or so if Bork had been nominated.
Sure. So Kennedy, who eventually ended up in this seat, was not a liberal by any stretch of the imagination. He's a conservative Reagan appointee who occasionally comes down with the liberals on things like LGBTQ rights and the right to choose, mostly due to his sort of libertarian streak that bucks the Federalist Society line a little bit. But the difference between him and Bork is enough to swing some of the most important cases of the last 30 years or so. And you can do pretty easy math here. Bork died in December 2012 at age 85. So he was 2 years older than Stephen Breyer is right now. which if you want to hear more about that, you can check out my Twitter feed or what I'm writing these days. And 2 years younger than Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the time of her death. So what comes out differently if Bork's in that seat? The biggest one is Planned Parenthood v. Casey, 1992. There were four justices in that case who were ready to overrule Roe. If Bork's there instead of Kennedy, that could have been it for abortion rights. But I also want to draw attention to some criminal justice cases. Roper v. Simmons, 2005. Kennedy writes an opinion holding that the death penalty for young people who committed their crimes when they were under age 18 is unconstitutional. That overturned laws in two dozen states.
Wow.
Similarly, Miller v. Alabama, 2012, Kennedy joins the liberals to decide that mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles is unconstitutional. These are really key decisions, long overdue steps towards making the criminal legal system like marginally less terrible than it is. Mm. And with Bork on the court, they almost certainly come down the other way.
Final question as we wrap up here, just going back to the sort of legacy and Borking as a catchphrase. You know, Brett Kavanaugh name checks Bork and says what's happening to him is a Borking during those hearings. And, you know, I think it's clear that what happened to Brett Kavanaugh is becoming a sort of like story that is being told within conservative legal circles, even though obviously he was approved. I'm curious, you know, if 20 years from now, people are going to be talking about the Kavanaughing, I guess it's just not as catchy of a phrase as Borking, or, you know, but will Kavanaughing replace Borking as the sort of catchphrase for unfair treatment?
I mean, the level of grievance that I heard from folks after Kavanaugh went through his confirmation hearing surprised me. I mean, I had my own grievances about Kavanaugh's hearing, but on the right, it hit an emotional core in the way that the Bork case hit an emotional core. I don't know that he's necessarily going to rise to the pantheon in grievance politics on the right that Bork has, because he ultimately got the seat.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating the way that it resonates in very similar ways, even though Brett Kavanaugh got everything he wanted.
And it also is interesting, we've seen this in previous episodes, but just the longstanding, I said what I said, in the Republican Party, where people hold their ground no matter what, whether it's, you know, wrong and you have receipts or not. It doesn't matter. They are emphatic about their beliefs and their behavior, and they will stand by it until the death.
Yeah, so Kavanaugh was a 1L during Bork's confirmation hearings. And it's interesting to look
at. First year law student,
I went full insufferable jargon. Yeah, first year law student. But it's interesting if you look at this playing out again, 30 years later. Yeah, my view on this is like, I never thought Kavanaugh was a particularly strong nominee for the court. I mean, even if you set aside the credible sexual assault allegations against him, just like eminently replacement level dude. Like, there are, like, 10,000 sort of ruddy-faced Republican operatives in the D.C. suburbs who have law degrees and could do exactly what Brett Kavanaugh is doing right now. And it would have been so easy, once his nomination ran into real trouble, to just drop him and pick someone else. Trump had the whole list, right? But that's what they did with Bork. They caved once there was Democratic opposition. And for Senate Republicans, they couldn't do that again. So the Democratic opposition made him their guy. They were going to rally around him. His lines in his confirmation hearings about, you know, the opposition being revenge on behalf of the Clintons, that's really a not so subtle signal about what was going on there. It's all references to this long-running judicial confirmation war that for them really started with Robert Bork and has justified everything that's happened since.
Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Jay Willis, thank you so much. And people can read his writing, not about stuff that happened 35 years ago, much more about the pressing issues on the court right now, at the new site, Balls and Strikes. But thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you all so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
The judge's responsibility is to discern how the framers' values, defined in the context of the world they knew, apply in the world we know. In Robert Bork's America, there is no room at the inn for blacks and no place in the Constitution for women. And in our America, there should be no seat on the Supreme Court for Robert Bork.
Radiotopia.